So, Tom, thank you very much for coming. And this is a nice collection of people at the Brennan Center. Probably 65% of the people here working in wonderful fields, democracy and justice and liberty and national security, and I think doing marvelous work. And Tom's book, which he wrote with Norm Ornstein, they having written several other books together, is a really up the alley of our work and highly important to what we do and highly important to the country. It analyzes how the partisan divide that we have is worse than ever imagined, and that's the subtitle of the book, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, and the major title, It's Even Worse Than It Looks. It has the thesis that in a parliamentary system, you could have this kind of division and still have an effective government, but with our separation of powers and other institutions, you cannot have as partisanly divided a system, a polity, a elected official, and accomplish anything. And then it analyzes, so that's sort of a fundamental building block to the book, and then it analyzes ways in which it is worse than it looks. Then it has a lengthy section about remedies that don't work. And then it has an important, vital section about remedies, I think, that you would say that might work. Maybe you say they will work. It's a very powerful book, and we're very, very lucky to have Tom here, and he's going to talk for a while. And then I know none of you were shy, because we've done this with other authors, and you guys are good. But be good, and you have a especially smart and knowledgeable person here, so ask hard questions that will make us all proud of how smart you are.
Wow.
Fritz, thank you. I'm delighted to be here. I actually did some work with the Brennan Center many years ago at the beginning of the efforts that eventually produced the McCain-Feingold bill. It was really some research on the extent to which so-called issue ads were transparently campaign and political ads, but certain things needed to be documented, and that research took place here, and I was on a small advisory committee to oversee it and plan it, and over the years have worked with various members of the center, most recently it'd be Wendy. I think very highly of you, and I'm pleased to be here. Let me also just say that I was happy to see, I was a founding board member of the Campaign Legal Center, Trevor Potter's, and I'm happy to see you guys are collaborating some, and I just think that's all to the good. They've been swinging above their weight. It's a small outfit, but an absolutely critical one, and I've been working hard to make sure they continue. Any of you who know me know that I'm not a natural critic of our constitutional system. I'm not a goody two-shoes. I like politics, and I know it ain't beanbag. I don't glamorize the past. I don't think we've ever had a golden era in American politics. We've certainly had periods of rough and tumble partisan politics in the early 1800s, in the lead up to the Civil War, in the post-Reconstruction period, leading to the turn of the century. So we've seen a lot of what we're complaining about before. It's also the case that my co-author and dear friend of decades, would you believe 45,
have... The number seems smaller.
are not partisans. That doesn't mean we don't have our own personal views as citizens, but we've really tried to make our way in Washington by watching, studying, writing about, talking about the way our system works and when it doesn't, and how we might deal with it, which has led us to to a situation where most people never haven't a clue as to what our personal citizen views of the world are. They make certain assumptions based on the fact that Norm is at AEI and I'm at Brookings, but that probably misleads more than anything else, but it certainly serves our purpose because we get a hearing that we might not otherwise get. So all of that is true. We're not alarmists, but we have become alarmed. We have become increasingly concerned about the state of American politics and governance. And we've also become convinced that one of the biggest problems we face is not getting the story straight about what has happened and what's going on. You can't change the system, improve it, until you know what it is. What's the problem? What's driving it? Tocqueville observed many years ago that Americans were peculiar in many respects, but one of them was its capacity for self-criticism and renewal, that we didn't pretend we lived in the best of all possible worlds. The jingoism about American exceptionalism is more recent a phenomenon. Back then, we acknowledged we had problems, and we tried to deal with them. And it's in that spirit that we approach this book. But what we were increasingly of the belief that people like us, people at think tanks that aspire to do our jobs in a nonpartisan way, journalists, academics to some extent, and make their living as, quote, pundits without being sort of partisan activists. We're all suffering from the same disease, and the disease is that we really try to be fair, in the immortal words of Fox, fair and balanced, right? But honestly, we really try to get it straight. But what happens when you insist on imposing a framework of balance when the underlying reality is not balanced? It's unbalanced, or is it imbalanced? In any case, it's not symmetrical, it's asymmetrical. I'm just carefully observing people at work, including ourselves. We just noted that again and again. It's partly a way that we have of beating back people who will charge us with partisan bias. We've got media outfits now on the left and right who are counting every word of every statement and seeing which can be labeled as positive or negative, and that's become a big part of the world in which we exist. And we came to feel as if, as a consequence, the public was being misinformed about what was going on in our politics and effectively demobilized and disarmed because they're all in it together. It's utterly corrupt. The system is broke. Parties are polarized and, you know, they're both to blame and we just got to get rid of these people. Effectively losing any opportunity for strategic decision making by informed voters and for politicians sort of believing in fact that what they were doing would somehow be they would be held accountable for their behavior. Anyways, that was the sort of backdrop, and as we saw, certainly after Obama's election, but well before it, we saw that it was taking on an entirely different dimension. That is to say, the permanent campaign had become the permanent war. The connection between campaigning and governing was, you could say, on the one hand, was even more tightly bound, but distressingly separate. That is, what people were saying in the campaign had absolutely nothing to do with the governing situation that we faced. And one of our political parties, we just had to recognize, has over a period of decades, and I'm talking about the Republican Party. The Democrats had their opportunity in the 60s and 70s, and since then, it's the Republican Party that has driven this, and it's picked up a special intensity since Obama was elected. But it's in the book, we frame it in rather stark terms, and I knew when I wrote these words that it would be the first sentence quoted. The second is the fact that, however awkward it may be for the traditional press and nonpartisan analysts to acknowledge, one of our two major parties, the Republican Party, has become an insurgent outlier, ideologically extreme, contemptuous of the inherited social and economic policy regime, scornful of compromise, unpersuaded by conventional understanding of facts, evidence, and science, and dismissive of the legitimacy of its political opposition. Wow. That's not your wonky kind of, on the one hand, on the other statement. And yet, we do our best in the book to document that rather aggressive charge. In my mind, to understand today's Republican Party, you have to see that it, in many cases, sincere belief that everything has soured, and at root, the problem is government and the role it plays in our society. It's a really aggressive form of economic libertarianism but it's mixed up with a general very strong feelings about who's a real American, so that there's a social dimension combined with an economic libertarian dimension that basically rejects the opposition, sees no value in negotiating or compromising with them because they are apostates, and have in mind just continuing and playing the same game, that the ends justify the means, and a kind of disrespect for science. You know, evolution is a theory. There are a lot of theories. Climate change, who can say? There are a lot of differences of opinion. No acceptance and certainty about facts. It produces a different kind of a player, and with Obama's election, we saw something we hadn't seen before. You see it in the beginning of the Bush administration after the 2000 election, and then the Obama administration after 2008. Remember, 2000 was the most controversial presidential election a century, at least. A 5-4 decision by the court, predictable by the party that appointed each of the justices, cut off a Florida Supreme Court mandated recount, and the election was called for George Bush. Think of what Democrats did then compared to what Republicans did after Barack Obama was elected. And remember, the country was not in a crisis in 2001. It was in 2009 very seriously. In 2001, you know, Democrats, he's our president and we'll go to work. That doesn't mean they didn't fight and resist efforts, but right away they started negotiations on No Child Left Behind. Max Baucus obliged the Bush and the Republicans and some of his Democratic colleagues on a tax cut. They're, you know, they did business together in all the while resisting and fighting in 2009 as new book that sort of follows the Tea Party members in Congress for their first couple of years has a prologue that reports on a dinner at the caucus room in Washington on the night of Obama's inauguration. Called, I think, by Frank Luntz. It was mainly House Republican leaders and activists. Jim DeMint was there and a few others. And you read that, and they were, you know, they were reeling from the defeat, but said our way back to power begins in 2010, and the way we get there is to make Obama a failure. And the only way we can make that happen is we stick together and refuse to engage in any negotiations. Mitch McConnell said as much 2 years later, but those discussions were held in the Republican conference in the Senate as well. So it was an all-out parliamentary-like opposition party. As Fritz mentioned, the building block of a parliamentary opposition party doing what it could to oppose and discredit, but in effect, in a parliamentary system, they would have lost, and things would have moved through. The majority would have had their program, and then 3 or 4 or 5 years later be held accountable, but not so here. The strategy was to delay, obstruct, defeat where they could, if not sort of damage and discredit. I went so far as to use the term new nullification to talk about a strategy of refusing to confirm the appointment of individuals they deem qualified to serve in key positions implementing legislation that had passed and been signed into law because they didn't like the law. It was really just a stunning all-out effort of opposition, which then led to all kinds of purely strategic behavior. Even when they didn't have a difference, if you can hold up a nomination or an appointment of some kind, you know, through holes and other ways, even if it's ultimately approved unanimously or with 99 votes, you can take 4 weeks of Senate time and therefore weaken the effort to get other things done. The debt ceiling hostage taking is our initial case and point, and we go to pains to show the new precedent set by this. John Boehner advised against it. He was rolled, and now he's advocating it again. It's really really quite stunning behavior. If you think about it, in the midst of our economic crisis, I mean, it began under President Bush, who was courageous enough to accept a recommendation from his Secretary of Treasury, Paulson, to do things he, George Bush, did not want to do, but believed were essential to avoid utter catastrophe, and then found Republicans abandoned him on the floor as they had abandoned the first President Bush with the first serious deficit reduction effort way back in 1990. Anyways, a series of actions, which often included opposing measures they themselves had embraced 2, 3, 4, 5 years earlier because Obama's name was on it. It was all about the war and nothing about the governing. The incentives were there. The capacity to do it was there because of our constitutional system, because of the Senate filibuster, and the motivation to do it beyond incentives, a sort of new tribalism and sort of belief, we know what we have to do to save this country. It's just completely collapsing, and we have to dramatically reduce the role of government. Anyways, if you don't understand that and accept it, I think you don't understand how our politics has played out in recent years. And two, it leads you to look more skeptically on the search for bipartisanship and on the strained efforts to do so. Because you gotta have two partners, you know. If you're engaged in a prisoner's dilemma situation and you're trying to find a cooperative arrangement that would serve the interest of both, if one party defects, and I would consider the Norquist tax pledge a defection, if all you do is sort of try to move closer to them, It doesn't produce the desired outcome. The better one would be a strategy and game theory of tit for tat. And so it means hard-nosed politics, making explicit the differences, and taking it from there. Obama was either naive or somewhat irresponsible and cynical in making so much of his post-partisanship. I understand it was his signature brand. It's what took him out of nowhere in 2004 and put him in the White House in 2009. So it was really something that was important to him. But he was in the Senate long enough to know that the ingredients for that did not exist. Okay, that's sort of the case, and we lay it out in great pain, and I was happy to see at least part of it was embraced by Jeb Bush the other day, who really identified the problem. Of course, then the Republicans in Grover started beating up on him, and so before you know it, we were back to symmetric. They both do it, and, you know, seeing no distinction. But in fact, he was speaking the truth. After my session at the Council on Foreign Relations, a man who identified himself as a Republican official from New Hampshire, been very active in politics, he said, "I read your book. It's even worse than you say it is." And it started just going on. He said, "My party, they just see Obama as evil incarnate and all the people around him. It's worse than Hitler and Stalin." I mean, this kind of stuff is out there, and it's sadly these people have been embraced and invited in rather than in some ways ostracized. So it's a big problem, and most of the solutions, you know, people pursue are likely to do more harm than good. We talk about those. We talk about sort of structural changes, which are really for the longer term. You know, one, can we alter our electoral system in ways that would diminish the level of ideological polarization of the parties? We obviously talk about everything from increasing turnout in general and in primary elections through reform to different kinds of electoral rules and the like. On the institutional side, we say if we're going to have parliamentary-like parties, let's get our rules a little closer to majority rules. So when you have the, however temporary, unified party government, let it govern and then be held accountable. There are advantages to our system when there's a willingness to negotiate. But there is no such willingness now, and it's counterproductive. Finally, we say, well, what do we do in the short term, and there it's a whole host of things, from recreating a public square to reintroducing the whole notion of shame, public shame. One to shaming the reporters back into covering the story and the truth rather than simply both sides, and something to politicians to think through how they can assist that fraction of the electorate, which is very small and not already committed, to do something other than just a pure visceral referendum. Things are going bad, throw the rascals out. It just repeats the cycle and gets us nowhere. The final couple of words. This has been the most extraordinary experience, writing and promoting this book, of my professional life, and the same is true for Norm. We didn't expect anything like this. We got lucky. It was serendipity. The editor of the Outlook section of the Post asked to read our manuscript. We gave it to him. He liked it. He said, "I want to have a lead piece in the Outlook section just before the book is published." And so we negotiated with him what arguments, what piece would... We didn't just want to take a section of the book, and so we wrote it. He put it up like 3 days before it was printed in the Post. I think it went up Thursday afternoon. It was printed on Sunday. The book's pub date was Tuesday. It went absolutely viral. Absolutely viral. It didn't hurt that he had given it a rather provocative title. Let's just say it. The Republicans are the problem. Well, coming from Mann and Ornstein, as we have been referred to, these establishment sort of fair-minded analysts of politics. Norm had explained to me what going viral means. Apparently, if you get 50,000 Facebook likes, you know, then, well, we got over 250,000. The comments section hit its maximum count within 24 hours, 5,000. Carlos reports that the article was accessed 1.5 million times, more than anything that they had put online at the Post before. And so then it started going out to the blogs and sort of people talking, and we then started promoting the book. The high point so far, which has finally legitimized my job with my children, was the Daily Show, of course. I even got them to come and be in the audience and raising hell. It was wonderful, but there's been an outpouring of, let me say, positive responses in the private message. Not the 5-10% sort of hate mail, what are you saying, whose agents are you? Tons of self-identified Republicans who thank us and tell us, oh my God, finally someone is saying it. And now the book's out, it's getting sort of talked about. They're finally getting... you know, some people who take issue with it. We haven't seen a single elected current Republican official who said anything for attribution to it. I don't think they want to call attention to it. It's, you know, it's an awkward thing for them. But it sort of tells you every once in a while you hit a nerve. These liberal bloggers sort of write to us, and what's the big deal? We've been saying some of this, you know, for years. Why, you know, well, it's true. Some of the pieces of our argument have been out there and kicked around, the false equivalence notion and other things. But what made a difference is because it came from an unexpected source, and embedded in a book that could be considered, I hope, scholarly, that it's serious, lively, and I hope too, colorful in some of its language. And so it made a difference. And but whether because I think it's really kind of scary, and I'll end with this. It's a scary point in our politics. The war is so intense, and the clashing visions so great that we now have one what I call old style conservative party. That's the Democratic Party, who's looking to. Who sees the challenges in demography and healthcare cost and globalization to the sort of basic structure of policy that's evolved over years and is perfectly willing to change it, to engage in negotiations to do it. And the other is sort of a radical party that says, no, we don't want to fiddle around the edges to keep this. This is the opportunity to get rid of it. Entirely, and that means it's become a holy war. All's fair in love and war. It kind of reminds you of the Crusades, and in some respects, we see it with work the Brennan Center is involved in voter suppression. We see it in the role of money. We see it in tactics used in Congress and in the press. It really is an all-out war, and you could say that American democracy looks more like a banana republic today than anything we would normally tend to associate with our democracy. If I had said all of this 5 or 10 years ago, if I had heard myself saying this, I said, oh my God, he's turned into a wacko conspiracy theorist. What has happened to this guy? But it happened, and I think mainly the case is correct. But I'm happy for you to tear down the argument or engage in the second discussion of the second half of the book about what to do about it.
Well, first, that was great, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It's a little bit like Lenin, who said, I just thought of this as you were talking, his slogan before the fall in Russia was the worse, the better.
Yeah, yeah.
I suppose one couldn't say that without being accused of engaging in something improper.
You know, it's really awful to say this, but it doesn't take rocket science to realize that the Republicans' route to power is a faltering economy. Everything else is trivial compared to it. Sort of what hurts the economy? Another debt limit crisis. Just even the threat of it gets people anxious. How about a little lobbying of the Germans to keep Europe on an austerity program for the next 6 months? We actually had. One of Governor Romney's top economic aides, the dean of the Columbia Law School, Glenn Hubbard, make that case
business,
in German newspaper
school,
this week. Huh?
Business school.
I'm sorry, I meant to say business. How about stop work on bread and butter infrastructure projects. So you find problems, you don't want to finance it, you know. Let's keep the uncertainty high there. You could just sort of go through the series of things that would contribute to this. Sure, I suppose you could say it's also consistent with their beliefs, but you know, this is a very serious time in the global economy. It's just not ours. And if the political dynamics have become
that destructive, you ask yourself, how in the world can you get out of that? How, can you govern successfully? Because I think right now that incentive, as you quoted from Lenin, is just that.
So, people, Sydney.
So I haven't read the book yet, and I'm going to rush home and read it right now. But so this question may be unfair, but from just looking at the title, there are obvious structural things wrong that produce this. I mean, the way we create our districts for Congress so that you don't have any competition in the districts, the most extreme people are elected, the filibuster, we don't have majority rule, but a lot of this is set up in the Constitution. I once wrote a memo to, I think I sent it to Michael, saying, why don't we start thinking about a parliamentary system? After all, Woodrow Wilson did that almost 100 years ago.
Jimmy Carter's too.
Pardon?
Jimmy Carter and Lloyd Cutler.
Right.
That's true. But all these are, it's pretty hopeless to think that we could change this Constitution, which reflects, in part, slavery, the Electoral College, and the way that the Senate is set up. So what do we do practically today, and what possible hope do we have of changing any of this?
A lot of the book really tries to get the story straight of the structural factors that have been involved, evaluating each of those so that we understand how our parties moved into a more polarized position and then why one of them veered much more sharply off the track, and certainly indicate that the mismatch of the constitutional structure with these new parties is profound. And obviously, as we discussed, one way is to sort of give it up, say the parties are going to be like this, and change the whole system, start from scratch. As you know, there's a bull market in constitutional reform these days. From Ackerman to Levinson to Sabato to many others. Sandy's having a conference down in Austin next January to take it on, and you guys have raised some, parsed the sort of constitutional room for different kinds of strategies on campaign finance reform. So all of what you say is true, but the book is filled with practical suggestions that can be done short of constitutional reform. Believe it or not, we could have mandatory attendance at the polls without a constitutional change. The Australians do well with it. I know it goes against every strain of personal freedom, but what's a $15 fine? Remember, look at what people are doing.
Since Australia has a $15.
Yeah, $15 fine. If you don't show up, all you have to do is take a ballot. You can leave it empty and put it in. You don't have to vote for anyone. You just have to show up and submit a ballot. You can write a letter saying, oh, my kid was sick and I couldn't get her. I was out of town. But the fact is, they're... Prior to 1925, when they passed this, their turnout was close to 50. Now it's universally above 90%, and it just changes the dynamics when you're not in the business of mobilizing and demobilizing parts of the electorate. You end up speaking to others who wouldn't normally be there and who aren't as responsive to the rhetoric of one's ideological base. It changes the center of gravity in some important ways. Of course, we have primary elections, and that's where the bigger problem emerges with unrepresentative and small electorates. So
we embrace experimentation with different kind of primary reforms as well. Money is a part of the picture, and we discuss that a lot in the book. And there, the constitutional obstacles are so enormous. Given Norm's favorite suggestion is collecting money voluntarily for early retirement fund for Anthony Kennedy. What do you think? but until we get really a different viewpoint on the court or a constitutional amendment, we're going to have to work around the edges of improving transparency, of trying to dramatically increase the number of small donors, and we'll probably have to engage in some tit for tat. Reform purist criticized Obama for changing his posture towards super PACs. I think that was wrong. I think in this environment, tit for tat, you got to play to win, not to lose. But you also have to make commitments to what you will do. That's within your power if you succeed in doing so. So EJ, my dear friend EJ Dion at Brookings, his latest column is just that, to try to discourage the Adelsons of the world by finding the liberal billionaires to match their contributions, kind of neutralize their money in the short term with a commitment to figure out a route to end it afterward. I'm not embracing that, but all of which is to say the book is filled with ideas for grappling with this over the longer hand. Filibuster reform is absolutely essential. The work goes on. We're quite explicit in what we recommend here. We've been talking to senators about it. They're going to try to bring it up again. But I'm saddened. We met with Senator Merkley, who's been one of the forces for good on this, and he's sounding a little wimpy, backing off into some things that are just too, in my view, too minor to make a difference. And of course, everything depends on who wins the majority in the Senate. It's up for grabs, and one doesn't know what will happen. But it seems to me one of the things we have to do is educate. Most members of the public haven't a clue of filibusters, of their prevalence, of how unusual their use is, how it was never anticipated in the Constitution by the framers, how it accidentally happened and then evolved over time to be an exceptional action of an intense minority that was designed to generate public attention. Everything is different with it now, and things need to change there. But we have other suggestions, institutional suggestions, and then, as I say, the final chapter is, okay, while we're working on these longer-term electoral and institutional changes, what can we do now? What can we do to help clarify choices, to induce more genuinely strategic voting, to discredit candidates who offer themselves as non-politicians and who won't spend any time in Washington and have contempt for the institution of which they're about to join. We do say there's no silver bullet for this. We're going through a rough patch. It's probably going to get worse before it's better. But a big part of it will be bringing the Republican Party back into a kind of mainstream of American party competition and governing. And it'll take shellacking at the polls a couple of times before that happens.
Do you think that New Hampshire Republican who spoke to you at the Council on Foreign Relations is going to vote against his party to punish his party and bring them back? And if they're going to do that, will they tell a pollster they're going to do that?
Yeah, that's a good question. I didn't. It was, you know, it was the rush after the session, and so our conversation was limited, and I didn't ask that. But my inference was that he could not vote now for the Republicans. But we didn't explicitly talk about it. Listen, there's no sign now that Republicans are defecting from their party. I expect 93% to 95% of self-identified Republicans will vote Republican. I expect a comparable number on the Democratic side, and there are more Democrats than Republicans. There's a little advantage there. We don't know what the advantage is as far as intensity and turnout. I don't think super PACs will have much of an effect in the presidential race, but I think they could have an enormous impact on congressional races, where an incremental million or five can make a difference, unlike a presidential election where each campaign is probably going to be close to $1 billion already, and after a while you have diminishing returns from additional expenditures. I think it's too confusing to get a clear, you know, Democratic theory says if one party strays too far from the median voter, they'll be punished. Well, that's really pretty tricky to do when you have split control of government, when you're really not certain about the party. Most people don't have a clue as to the implications of the Paul Ryan budget would be. They think government spending is run amok, but it's all in the part of the budget that is either foreign aid or discretionary domestic that is now at a level relative to the economy of the Eisenhower years. That ain't where the money is, and where the money is what those same voters believe are their programs, not the government's.
Thomas.
Hi. I have a question about how much of these problems do you think are related to our civic education? When you think about the idea that Republicans can deny science, deny facts, manipulate numbers, part of that can only happen if the person that's receiving the information has no tools to analyze it. We know what our schools are teaching kids about economics, what they're teaching about. We've got schools that are adopting evolution as a theory only, as a complete theory. Yep. So what happens when you have an electorate that's composed that way, that is therefore then vulnerable? What would you, A, do you think that makes any sense, and B, what would you suggest we do?
Yeah, that's a very good question. Let me say, one of the advantages of mandatory attendance at the polls is that the whole educational system then adapts to it and structures itself to prepare people for that responsibility. And so that kind of civics education, I mean, it's scary to some people who don't have the information, don't even know what it looks like when they go to vote and how to do it and how to navigate this. I mean, I think all of those efforts are really constructive, and certainly one of the reasons why you have the lowest levels of turnout among the youngest cohort is the unfamiliarity, the lack of experience and practice, as well as the high levels of mobility that, you know, you could compensate some for. I'm sure some of you have done work in this area and seen it, but it's stunning the impact in some experiments of a class, say, in junior year of high school, sort of dedicated to finding out what an election is all about, which includes registering and then going to a voting precinct and learning how to use the machines and seeing about it, having sessions in class about the campaign and you know, the debates about what's going on, and being required every day to read a newspaper. That's the real, and not a a tabloid, but a New York Times or the news section of the Wall Street Journal. I would never advise the editorials for anyone. That's, we consider those their equivalent of the comic page. So, yeah, some things can be done, and they ought to be done, and that doesn't, you know, that would be helpful, but we've got to remember that we're never going to have an electorate that looks like those in attendance at New England town meetings. You know, we have a republic, not a direct democracy. What we need to do is structure it so that we recruit responsible people to run for and win office, who have some degree of civic virtue, Republican virtue, as well as political ambition, and set up the institutions and the incentive systems so that you get a form of accountability between a public that is only intermittently engaged in this and office holders who do it for a living and a lifetime. And so all of those things have been thrown off kilter, and we've got to do something about it. But it's too much to require every citizen to be as wonkish as most of the people in this room.
Yeah. I have a question about ideology that maybe leads to a question about political violence. There are a number of ways you could think about the rhetoric of delegitimation that you talk about. One is simply that we are absolutely certain that the Republic would be better off if we were in power therefore and justify the means. And you could say whatever sticks. Another is that a significant number of elected officials and the electorate believe that that it truly is an illegitimate government when the Democrats are in charge, that that Obama is a usurper, an alien, a false president and a tyrant. And there's, you get the language of sort of the Minutemen and of sort of the original tyranny that led to the American Revolution. And I'm wondering if you've got any sort of thoughts or data on, I mean, to what extent people really believe the latter, and whether you see the potential or the beginnings of actuality of greater political violence. I mean, if you took seriously the idea that this guy was actually not the president and was imposing a tyranny on the country, it seems like, you know, you would fight.
That's a very sobering question, but it really needs to be addressed. Throughout our history, we've had sort of radical movements, extreme movements in our politics, on the left and in the right. What is different in my view now is that the Republican Party establishment, the leaders, are not willing to speak out against some of these excesses that seem almost to verge on violence. And that's the big difference. Someone said in response to our repeating Alan West's statement, there were between 79 and 81 members of the 79 to 81 House Democrats are members of the Communist Party. You know, and there was not a single Republican official who spoke out against that. And so the response was, well, look, when Cynthia McKinney was saying something that could be considered as extreme from the other poll, Democrats didn't speak out. Well, little research helps, you know. Google it and go back and see, and they're right there. They denounce what she said. It's not acceptable.
And, you know, in a system like ours, you really have to have that sense of what's in bounds and what's out of bounds for a democratic society to persist. And right now, that you can let percolate within your party, you know, close to, 35-40% who honestly believe that Barack Obama is not a U.S. citizen, and similar numbers that he's a Muslim. Now, one of the reasons is because that's what Rush says, and that's what some other people on Fox News say, and that's all the information some people get, and they just really believe it. This man from New Hampshire was talking about some particular cases, and it scared him. Coming within his own party. That's where, I mean, we have big shot U.S. businessmen doing the same thing. Stephen Schwarzman hasn't contributed too much to the Brennan Center. I know he owns most of the New York City Library and the Kennedy Center, but he was so offended at the idea of treating hedge fund partners' income as ordinary income instead of carried interest, since they had none of their own capital tied up on it, but was really a percentage of gains from others. He said it's equivalent to the Nazis invading Poland. Now think about that. It got a few mentions around, but I didn't see any of his fellow leaders in the business community speak out against it. It's we've defined deviancy down when it comes to politics. Thank you, Daniel Patrick Moynihan. He oversaw everything before any of us did, and it certainly happened here. And that's why there's a high priority to think about just this, about when sort of extremism ventures into violence, and what are the tipping points, and what are the interventions a society can take to keep it from happening?
So you don't need to pause on this, but when you guys read the book, there's a section called Restore Public Shame that is very responsive in part to you. Jonathan and Wendy and other people, put their hands up and I can put you down on the list. So Jonathan.
Would you mind getting me some Diet Pepsi or Coke with ice?
Thank you.
No more than 10 ounces, though.
We go all the way to
15. I thought, don't we have an exemption for diet soda? I'm so relieved.
So, Jonathan.
So I have so many questions that I'd like to ask you, but I want to... My question would be about filibuster reform.
Yep.
And I'm wondering, first, if you think that even at the beginning of this Congress, that the little gentleman's agreement that Reid and McConnell had changed at all anything that happened in the Senate. And two, what can we do, given the current levels of polarization and incentives for obstruction, to ever give a incentivize a majority to change the rules for fear that they become a minority?
Yeah. I think the informal agreement has been made and broken. It's lasted sometimes for two or three pieces of legislation when McConnell decides it's in his interest to have it come to the floor, and in return, Reid doesn't fill the amendment tree so they can offer some amendments, and he thinks the amendments will be more politically useful than keeping it off the floor. So it's of that sort. The compromises on appointees, judicial and executive, have been very modest and temporary. Thank you. So no, I don't. I think the incentive is too powerful for McConnell, although think about it was much more important in 2009 and 10 than it has been in 11, because in 11 there's a Republican House, so it doesn't matter. You're not killing things in the Senate with a filibuster, so that takes some of the pressure off the filibuster in this go round. But it's still very much a part of the appointments process. You know, you got two powerful incentives against filibuster reform. You know, one you could solve through the veil of ignorance, that is, approve it now to go into effect sometime in the future when you don't know who's going to be in the majority. Thank you, Rawls. You know, we knew we'd get something out of him that would be practical. But, of course, even that, members think, well, party control changes now, and so they worry about being in the minority and not having it. But even more significant is the fact it's the basis of power of individual senators. And it's just appalling. It makes the Senate the most dysfunctional legislative body in the democratic world, in my view, because they become so self-indulgent, self-righteous, believing they have something so important. Chuck Grassley is always convinced every idea he has, every concern he has, is the most important, and holding up anything is just fine for it. You know, that's changing because they're getting embarrassed and they're getting, frankly, tired of being members of the Senate. It's an awful job, the way it's evolved over time. And recently, there were counts of as many as 46 Democrats who were willing to vote for a package of reforms. In the old days, you would have had a dozen Republicans willing to come aboard. Now, not a single one will commit. But Reid has indicated for the first time, even he has gotten impatient and tired, and said he would be open to it. For those of you who haven't looked into this, there is an argument that the Senate rule that was passed, I think that one in 1975, as part of a change in the form of cloture, said to change a Senate rule, to cut off debate on changing a Senate rule, you had to have a two-thirds majority. There is a constitutional view to which I subscribe that says every legislative body, after an election in which its composition changes in some way, has the right by simple majority to set its rules. The framers gave them the power to set their rules, and they listed those special circumstances that would require supermajorities. I think the argument that the intention was majority rule, that the Senate is no different than the House in being a body that's reconstituted, if only in part, every 2 years, and therefore you could do this with a simple majority and a favorable ruling from the chair. If something happened, which almost no one thinks will happen, that is, if Obama's elected, and more than by just a wink, and Democrats not only hold the Senate but retake the House, then incentives exist for the Senate Democrats to use the constitutional option, as they say, and change the rules. And even Sander Levin, who's really one of the bulls, who's a good senator but is very uncomfortable with changing Senate rules, is warming up to it. But that's unlikely to happen, that is, that election outcome, unless you know, Europe suddenly solves all of its currency problems. We have a new boom, and growth jumps to 3% instead of below 2. I'm not expecting that, but that is increasingly in the game. Let me tell you, filibuster reform used to be a pipe dream. It's not anymore. It's well worth working on. And there are things you can do to preserve, for those extraordinary circumstances, the ability to delay votes. But it would shift the burden to the minority. And not keep the burden on the majority. Right now, the majority, to move, has to have a quorum, and all it takes is one senator to object to a unanimous consent agreement, and then, you know, they go through the long cloture process. If you reverse that responsibility and require the minority to have 41 votes opposing cloture to keep something going, it would change things dramatically. You could also put appointments on certain kind of fast tracks with at least for the executive branch, and the big one would be giving the majority leader the power to bring anything to the floor and limit the filibuster to the vote on the underlying measure.
Wendy.
My question is about advocacy. So part of what you're doing here is working to solve the problem by naming the problem and teaching everyone this is a problem. And I'm just wondering to hear from you as to, first, how do you avoid, and have you been avoiding the situation by naming one side or one party as the wrongdoer, just being placed on the other side and then marginalized as a shill for the other side, and you know, maybe it's the long respected history of your work, and then how have you been, and how do you plan to be, and what can others do to support? You've been going about trying to build a consensus as to what's in bounds and out of bounds, at least from the in the out of Congress sphere, and in the media among other commentators, so that at least there are other guardians of what the boundaries ought to be.
Yeah, really good questions. In some ways, certain people will never look at Norm and me the same. That is, we've said this and we've shown our colors, and they can't trust us. But at least our impression so far is there are people in the media who believe what we're saying is true, and there are people in the Republican Party, most of them out of office now, who believe what we're saying is true. It sort of, as I say, it helps that Norm is at AEI, and there was a debate between Norm and Steve Hayward. At AEI last week. It was on C-SPAN, and it was, frankly, very good for AEI, because increasingly their new president, Arthur Brooks, is speaking as if everyone is lined up in formation behind him and the particular ideas he's espousing, and a think tank a credible one can't survive like that, and therefore showing differences is really a healthy thing, and so that word gets around and kicks around, and we'll see. I mean, we're going to keep doing it for sure. When we wrote The Broken Branch, it was easy for people because we weren't, we were looking institutionally, and we were looking at polarization more generically, and we were critical at the time, and the Republicans were in power in the Congress, so some didn't like that, but some Republicans, held the book up in campaigning because they were singled out as respecting regular order and being serious legislators and the like.
This they were embarrassed by.
Now it may be a very different thing. So the answer is, I don't know, but I'll keep you informed how it plays out over time. I don't think it's run its course yet, and we'll see. And we are going to try to work on some of the ideas here, and one of them is.
We hope to work with you.
Yeah, and we all ought to talk about that. The question is, what's in bounds and what's out of bounds? And I don't want to get it caught up in these sort of civility debates and discussions, because that takes all the real charge and politics out of it in a way, and tends to demobilize people. I think as we were talking earlier, we're talking about much more serious things than tough language. We're talking about profoundly sort of destructive and violence and incentivizing things, and that's worth doing. But it's all at the beginning. We haven't. You know, we don't have a plan. We're trying to keep up with just, promoting this book. Let me tell you, the idea for this book came from a former editor last August. Okay? It was in the middle of August. By the end of the month, we'd agreed to write a short book and put together an outline. We had to write it in 4 months while we were doing our other jobs, and then work hard to get it out, edited, and out in April. So we've just been running like crazy and haven't had time to think of what might follow and the implications of it, but there are many pieces to pick up and run with, and we hope you guys get interested in pieces of it. Many are things that that you're leading on already.
Johnny Butler,
what's your why is it this way now? Is this a pendulum moment, and we're at the extreme swing of a pendulum, or is this the result of an arc of the American polity and change in our world and the world around us that has led to this kind of polarization?
I don't think it's as neat as a pendulum. I mean, we go through different periods. By the way, if I can tout another book, Our Divided Political Heart, a book by E.J. Dionne, a wonderful, wonderful, rich, historical and philosophical book. We are one at the same time individualist and communitarians. You know, the secret of our success is our great respect for both of them, and we are, God, we believe in freedom and individual opportunity and speech and the like. But at the same time, and you can go through the language of the Declaration and the Constitution, it's sort of we the people. It isn't me and you, and it really is built on the notion that we're in this together in ways, and that a purely libertarian conception of society is simply at odds with our constitutional founding and our critical values, and that both parties have tried to balance this over time. And And Republicans, Hamilton, Clay, Lincoln, for starters, before we get to the 20th century, really saw that community, group, government, public goods and activities as being essential to our democracy. But then other things would intervene, and other interests come forth. Progressive movement growing out of the Republican Party was part of that. At times you could argue that the New Left movement in the 60s put too much, it was sort of anti-we and pro-me. It was more individually oriented and deeply suspicious of government and collective activity. So there, these, you know, this gets out of balance both between parties and within parties, and I just think we're searching for the right balance. Now we're having a major challenge to the notion that both are important in American society, and we're trying to wrestle with it. But the seeds of that, those doubts, were planted with the development of government, the opposition of Franklin Roosevelt, some of the Goldwater movement, and then sort of building up to the Tea Partiers and the Koch brothers and libertarians and the like. I mean, Democrats sort of made their adjustments. They've made their peace with markets. That's not an issue. That is the driving force of the U.S. economy, they believe. And Clinton and Obama are, you know, reposition the Democrats as center-left parties that look pretty conservative relative to the rest of the Democratic world. So the answer is, one way or another, we're gonna regain our balance, I hope, if this thing doesn't just completely unravel and get out of control. But I think there are enough people who sort of care about that, and they see about that, and they become active, and opportunities are presented to voters where it's not as confused as it sometimes is, and you get signals, and you begin making adjustments, attracting new people into office, and use of a public square and public shame, and changing the rules of the game, and things look a little better. I'm inherently an optimist who's just really discouraged by our state of affairs, and I figure rather than getting just cranky and ornery, the better thing is just to try to lay it all out there and see if we can't get people talking about it.
So one more question, or are there two more? Okay. One, two, three, and then that's it, all right?
So Cornel West's new book is now claiming that one out of every two Americans is either in poverty or on the verge of poverty. And I wonder, this is also, we have more middle-class Americans than ever, many of whom are Republican, visiting food pantries. At the same time, there is a push to make a $33 billion cut in food stamps. And I wonder if there is a possibility that just the urgency of the entire situation of all, the apolitical situation of all Americans will force this system to change, or whether what you're positing in this very intricate political bureaucracy means that the needs of the people are fundamentally distinct from what politicians do.
Yeah. Listen, there is no question that in these difficult economic times, and they have been going on for a couple of decades. Remember, we've had stagnant wages, growing inequality, reduced opportunity and mobility, high debt from student loans, among other things. So it's been a tough time. And part of, if you study the Tea Partiers, almost all of them are former Republicans, but many really are middle class and even lower middle class. And what you find is their belief is the problem is government has directed so many resources to the undeserving poor, to the people who, you know, who don't carry their own weight. They're just sort of convinced that that's why they're not doing better. Instead of, you know, being resentful of the top 1% or 1/10 or 1/100th of a percent. And that sort of really complicated coalitional and partisan politics in America. On the one hand, though, I think the efforts of completely changing the composition of the budget to reduce assistance, even in the form of the Affordable Care Act, but certainly thinking of food stamps and housing subsidies and student loans and other things, there remains a reservoir of support. But the real issue, and it's connected to race, but is by no means limited to it, is sort of diminishing opportunities and a sort of self, you know, really harmful, destructive cycles of incarceration and unemployment following it, and then sort of destructive social behavior. It's terrible, and the question is how in the world we manage to produce an economy that for a while we did, which offered some opportunities across the board once we got rid of outright discrimination. And people have ideas about what to do, and they're profoundly different ideas about what would create the basis of that new opportunity and performance. But it's a central question facing our society.
So Nick, and then Sadia, you're going to wind up.
I'm willing to cede for the sake of time.
You don't need to, Nick.
Okay, all right. Well, I guess my question then is, since Fritz is let me off the leash a little bit, is about the state of journalism in this country and the role that the press plays in perpetuating some of the dysfunction that you've described.
Yeah.
And you speak specifically in your, you know, reform proposals about shaming reporters and the need for a more informed electorate and how that's a way forward, at least. And so I guess my question is, just given that journalism, the state of journalism right now is in an equally precarious state to some of the institutions that you described, our democratic institutions, I wonder what that looks like in a more concrete way. How do we go about that process? Because, I mean, you know, the Fox News and some of the problems that you describe with the press are some of the only models of successful journalism in terms of financially successful and sustainable
exactly.
that we've seen. And so we're up against market forces and popular forces. Voters, the electorate, media consumers they like to be having their views reaffirmed
right.
with facts or non-facts or whatever it takes. And so, you know, so given that we're up against that, and also against, you know, we're in an era where politicians can get their message out without going through the press now. Barack Obama can buy a half-hour ad during the World Series, and that was before Citizens United. You know, there's increasingly extremist groups or politicians themselves can access, you know, the public without going through journalists as they once had to. In light of all that, how do we kind of move forward with that?
Gee, I think I'll turn that over to Wendy or someone. That's a very serious question and an important one. And I don't claim to have any real answers for it. But I think that whole world is in a state of flux that we don't have a clue as to where it's going to eventually settle. I mean, the Fox business model is fascinating. It's been so successful. Is Murdoch lucky he's had that because it's made bucks while everything else is crumbling on him. And no one has quite managed to deal with that. I mean, one of the real keys here is what will we be able to maintain any really high-quality national news organizations. I consider the New York Times one of those, and I consider NPR with its vast expenditure on international news and so on as well.
a part of that. I'm encouraged by some of the investments in ProPublica and other efforts at investigative journalism. I'm thinking you're going to have different kinds of information delivered in very different formats and with different economic models underlying them, that you could imagine the sort of local news having little print outlet, but still using some of the advantages of the internet, of actually producing some very useful coverage. And you could even imagine then the possibility of some national news outlets, products that really have a wide circulation, but a kind of more of a division of labor. You know, it's the best of times and the worst of times, and some of the things we can get now, if we're discerning consumers who really want good stuff and not just to be reinforced, it's really quite amazing what's out there and what one can learn. But the reality is that affects maybe, 10% of the electorate, the public, and that may be a sort of high opinion. What do you do about citizens who are busy with other things, the inadvertent viewer? How do you create a public square where there's, once again, something in common? All I can say is this is a case where technology has caused problems, but it also holds out some opportunities, and it's kind of like if we could divert, and there's a project on this now, some fraction of the our best college graduates from going into the financial services and consulting industries into forms of venture capitalism, of creating new kind of entities from the ground up, small and localized. There's so much talent in this country, and if we directed them to these questions as opposed to how do we extract five more percentage points, you know, out of a complex hedged derivative, then it'd be, I mean, that's where the real innovation has to come from. I'm the last one to be able to imagine. I'm so technologically out of step that. But it does give you hope that if you could put some of these people to work on some of these matters that have genuine public goods associated with them, you know, something good might come of it.
So, Sadia, your last question here.
I'm really looking forward to reading your book.
Oh, good! And it makes a wonderful Father's Day present, you know?
If only my father was interested in politics, so... what it seems like you're suggesting is a complete overhaul of the system. What I'm wondering is, from a realist perspective, which of your recommendations do you think are most likely to be implemented, or at least are easiest to implement?
None are easy. None are easy to implement. I'm studying the California experience with both redistricting and the top two primary. The initial read was somewhat negative. I think we have to wait until the general election to really get a feel for that. But you could imagine something starting in individual states, and we see how they play out, and then they begin to build up. So I'd think there's room for experimentation at the state and local level on different forms of electoral systems and rules that are well worth doing. I You've seen this effort now to try to compensate for the difficulty of changing the Constitution to get rid of the Electoral College, to develop a sort of state compact to ensure that the winner of the popular vote is the winner of the electoral vote. They've still got a ways to go, but you know, I sort of encourage things like this in the money arena. I'm still big on building out the small donor potential and multiple public matches and seeing how you could really make a step increase, what it would take to do that, and how millions of small donations could be seen as an offset to a handful of multi-million-dollar ones. Filibuster reform is something well worth working on, and frankly, there are discussions in newsrooms that are taking place now that weren't a few months ago. We've been told by reporters they have ammunition now to challenge some of the norms that are pushed on them that they think do not produce the best of journalism. So there, you know, there are some things out there that aren't so fanciful as to discourage you and sort of turn you to fiction forever, you know.
Well, Tom, this was magnificent. The talk you gave was worthy of the book. And they're both extremely worthy, and we're very grateful to you.
Thank you.